This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Our question for this hour, is the Republican Party's criminal machine starting to become unraveled? Maybe. You recall, for example, one of the main ways that the Republicans were able to ultimately track down Monica Lewinsky. And after, I think it was $74 million was spent in that investigation, there have been no parallel investigations since then, but after all these millions of dollars were spent on that investigation, ultimately they said, oh, who's this Lewinsky woman, and why does she keep going into the White House at these strange times? Well, that was because the visitor logs, the White House visitor logs, were considered public documents. They were subject to Freedom of Information Act filings. So the Bush administration comes into office and the Secret Service logs, the visitor logs, and they say these Secret Service logs are not Secret Service property, which would make them, subject to Freedom of Information Act laws, filings. They say these are actually presidential records, and therefore we can hide them for zillions of years, presumably 25 years. Well, a federal judge ruled yesterday, sorry, ain't so. U.S. District Judge Royce C. Lamberth says, no, these are public records. They must be turned over via the Freedom of Information Act. This is a result of a lawsuit from CREW, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, and good on them. Now, they were specifically looking for White House logs about people like James Dobson, Gary Bauer, and Jerry Falwell, the religious Reich. But in a separate case, they basically said, declare all these things illegal. The second case had to do with Jack Abramoff. We want to know what Jack Abramoff is up with. I'm curious about visits from, say, gay hookers. What's the deal with Jeff Gannon? But in any case, we'll see. In all probability, the Bush administration is going to appeal this, and they're going to, they're running out the clock. They're running out the clock, and that's all the more the tragedy. This is, they got Clinton early enough that he couldn't run out the clock. 398 days, 11 hours, 44 minutes, 10 seconds to go. But maybe, just maybe, we'll have access to this stuff. So we'll see. I see this as a great first step. Secondly, in today's news, the wheels coming off the Republican criminal machine, essentially the Republican mafia machine. Good on Chris Dodd, and we will be getting back to more of that in a little later on the program at the bottom of the hour. But Chris Dodd, one man, stood up yesterday to the Republican machine and, frankly, to the rollover Democrats who were going to go along with it, including Harry Reid, who was ignoring, and this is, I think, the big thing, who was ignoring a hole that Chris Dodd had put on this bill. There were two bills, two FISA bills, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Acts, two We Can Spy on People bills electronically. We can listen in on phone conversations. We can check email. Two of these pieces of legislation that came forward. One of them said the telecommunications companies, the phone companies, who are not idiots, they have lawyers, they have legal departments, that when they were complicit with the Bush administration in spying on people, perhaps including, I mean, I would say almost certainly including all the Democrats. Which leads us back to the J. Edgar Hoover question. What do the Republicans know about the Democrats, and are they blackmailing them? But setting that aside for the moment. One of these bills said, we're just going to let the phone companies off the hook, even though they broke the law. And they knew they broke the law, and their lawyers knew they broke the law. In fact, one of them, Quest, said, no, we're not going to break the law. Even though they broke the law, we're going to give them retroactive immunity, which, arguably could be used as a precedent for establishing retroactive immunity for all sorts of corporate enterprises that engage in criminal activity at the request of the administration. Like, for example, torturing people, or murdering people, or spying on people, or disrupting people's lives. So there were these two versions. The version that came out of the Intelligence Committee said, yeah, we'll give them immunity. The version that came out of the Judiciary Committee, Pat Leahy's committee, said no, no immunity. Chris Dodd had put a hold, in other words, tried to stop the intelligence community version, the one that said, yeah, we'll give him immunity. And although Harry Reid has been respecting the holds of many Republicans, he chose not to respect this hold. That in itself was bizarre. So Chris Dodd, on the campaigns, on the hustings out there in Iowa, flies back and says, no, I'm going to filibuster this thing. And he stands up, and although he didn't talk continuously, he allowed many of his colleagues, including some Republicans who talked against the thing. But he basically said, we're going to take control of the debate. And it went on for 7 or 8 hours. And finally, Harry Reid said, okay, enough already. We're going to withdraw this bill, this bill that gives the immunity, and we will revisit this issue in January. This is not over yet. This is just the beginning. So we need to thank Chris Dodd in whatever way you think it's appropriate, whether that means, you know, sending some money to his presidential campaign or sending him calling his office and saying good on you. And ultimately, I suppose we should be thanking Harry Reid for doing the right thing. I would suggest we also need to be letting the members of the Intelligence Committee, Jay Rockefeller, Dianne Feinstein, and others, to say, why did you send that bill up in the first place? And to thank Pat Leahy and others on the Judiciary Committee as saying, hey, good on you. Well done. But the issue I'd really want to get into is, as a larger part of this question of, are the wheels coming off the Republican Party's criminal enterprise? And in my opinion, it seems that the main engine behind this criminal enterprise in the Republican Party can be found at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. Messrs. Rove and Bush and Cheney and Card and the others. Again, I've from the very beginning of this U.S. attorney scandal, where these guys appointed all these U.S. attorneys, I have been saying, don't look at the ones who were fired. There were all these hearings. They had all this testimony, the ones who were fired. I'm saying, look at the ones who kept their jobs. What did they do to keep their jobs? What were they doing that allowed them to keep their jobs? Now we're starting to find out. Donald Eugene Siegelman, Don Siegelman, the governor of Alabama. He has, as we have reported on this program, as Larissa Alexandrovna and others have reported on this program, is being held incommunicado in federal prisons. They were moving him around. The press was not allowed to talk with him. Larissa has done some great reporting on this. There's some great reporting over at Harper's Magazine as well. But nobody is talking about the real issue which started the whole thing, which is election fraud. Not voter fraud, not, some person saying, oh, I live in this county when actually they live in that county. Not Ann Coulter stuff. You know, she apparently, it is alleged that Ann Coulter had committed voter fraud by registering at her real estate agent's home rather than where she lives. That's small stuff. We're talking about election fraud, wholesale theft of elections. And Don Siegelman now coming out and speaking on this issue. And this, actually not now, this was back 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. He was speaking on this issue, and the tapes have surfaced. The videotape is now out, and I want to share parts of it with you during this segment and during the next few minutes, because I think this is really important stuff. There is no more important stuff than the beating heart of democracy. That's the absolute bottom line, the beating heart of democracy. And when that is corrupted and when that is stolen, we've got a real problem. To just open this, here's the beginning of this interview with Don Siegelman.
I do know that during my term as governor, I never saw Bill Pryor, the Republican Attorney General, do anything outside of Alabama law.
Now, let me just set this up. Bill Pryor is the guy who Bush finally recess appointed to a lifetime federal judgeship. Bill Pryor was the guy that helped set this thing up, that Siegelman would go to jail.
Except to allow the early certification of the results that swung the election from me to my Republican opponent.
Okay, so here we have him, Don Siegelman, starting out saying, okay, Bill Pryor, you know, he seems like a decent guy, except for the fact that he allowed the early certification of the election. Now, why is that important? What's this election all about? We'll get into that right after the break. But what we're talking about here is the theft of the governorship in Alabama, number one. Number two, the sitting Democratic governor from whom it was stolen, standing up and saying, hey, wait a minute, this election was stolen. And number three, Karl Rove and his buddies saying, okay, buddy, you're out of here, and throwing him in federal jail. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. So Don Siegelman, you know, in the corporate media coverage of this, they've covered the fact that the prosecutor, the U.S. attorney who prosecuted him, Mrs. Canary, was the wife of the guy who was running Bob Riley's campaign. Bob Riley was the Republican who supposedly beat him in what Siegelman suggests was a stolen election. I mean, he comes right out and says that, in fact. Now, that in and of itself you would think was very strange. But then on top of that, you find out that Bob Riley's campaign manager, in addition to being the husband of the woman who prosecuted Don Siegelman, was also working with Karl Rove. Back to Don Siegelman's interview.
What was disappointing was after the polls had closed, after midnight, when the poll workers, the Democratic poll workers and the Republican poll workers and representatives of the media had gone home, the election officials, all of whom are Republicans, got together and recounted the votes. In that process, I lost some 6,700 votes, enough to swing the election from me to my Republican opponent. Poll workers should have been present during that process. And secondly, the results should not have been certified the next day.
Although they were certified by Mr. Pryor, who then was awarded a federal judgeship by the Bush administration, even though the Senate wouldn't confirm him. He was so toxic, so the Bush had to do it as a recess appointment. So Don Siegelman here laying out, and by the way, we're having to play a 3.5-year-old tape of him telling this story because he's in lockdown in a federal penitentiary and not allowed to talk to the media about these issues. And let me just add, he was convicted of putting on the hospital board, on a volunteer, giving a volunteer job to a guy who was a campaign donor. That's what he was convicted of.
After we had made an official request for a hand count of the ballots in Baldwin County, and after the Attorney General and the Republican District Attorney had said they would put anyone in jail who attempted a hand recount, the votes were suddenly rushed to Montgomery, certified by the Republican Secretary of State, which put us at a disadvantage.
Yeah, you might think so. Yeah, the ballots that they found in the middle of the night. Keep in mind, he went to bed thinking he'd won the election. And suddenly in Baldwin County, the big Republican county, they came up with an extra 6,000 votes, enough to flip the election so that Riley won rather than Siegelman. This is Don Siegelman, the former governor of Alabama, the Democrat.
Now, under Alabama law, the anyone who wants to challenge the election must show that there were enough legal votes not counted or illegal votes cast to make a difference in the outcome. Well, the person challenging the election should have been my Republican opponent because the votes that should have been certified on 12 noon on Friday following the election should have been that first vote, which was publicly counted in front of poll watchers.
Yeah, but the Republican had no interest in challenging that because at the very last minute in the middle of the night, he won when they discovered some votes. Siegelman,
When this election was stolen, there's no other real kind or sugar-coated way to say it, I was faced with a difficult choice because it was a close election. We had won by what we thought was around 3,000 votes, and we ended up losing by I think, 1,500 votes.
And here he lays out basically the same logic I think John Kerry used in Ohio.
It would have been difficult for me to have challenged the outcome of that election. One, because they were denying me a hand recount. Secondly, even if we were to have ultimately gotten a recount from a Republican federal judge, very doubtful, from a Republican circuit judge, very doubtful, from a Republican-dominated state Supreme Court, we have one Democrat on the court, very doubtful, after what the United States Supreme Court had just done to Al Gore, I looked at the possibility of winning a legal challenge and thought, even if I were to win by any stretch of the imagination, if I could have won, then I was afraid that people would have looked at me and said, Sigelman stole the election because it was so close. So I decided to walk away from that, thinking that, it's best to come back and fight another day.
And then he started talking about it, and they threw him in jail.
I think some of my Republican friends here thought that, well, if he's coming back to fight another day, let's see if we can't make that fight a little more difficult for him.
And that's what they did. They went after this guy. They originally charged him, and this is absolutely mind-boggling. They originally charged him with something like 30 or 40 counts. These all got thrown out. They all got thrown out. And so then they came back and they charged him with this much smaller crime of having appointed a campaign donor to this hospital advisory board. But this is the middle of the night that the Republicans found all these votes. I mean, it's just totally, totally bizarre. Don Siegelman, one of many American political prisoners right now. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Coming up next, Chris Dodd is going to be with us 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Yes, there are some people out there you can trust. There are some people out there doing a great job for democracy in the United States, and one of them is Senator Chris Dodd. Senator, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on, and good to be on Air America all the time.
I just, we are so pleased to have you with us here, and our listeners live from Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle, through Denver, Detroit, and New York City, and Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh, and whatnot.
And Burlington, Iowa.
There you go.
Burlington, Iowa. We want to emphasize the Burlington, Iowa piece here.
There you go. We're just very pleased to have you with us. Setting aside the whole presidential race, although obviously it's impossible to set aside, but I wish you very well in that. But I wanted to get into what happened yesterday on the floor of the Senate. What brought you back to Washington, D.C., and what did you accomplish, and what are the short and long-term implications of this?
Well, Tom, first of all, let me thank Air America, because you've been talking about this as you have over the last number of weeks and months. This is a set of issues that I care passionately about. I've written about it, talked about it, been fighting for it for a long time, and made a commitment to myself a year ago when the Military Commissions Act went forward, and I opposed that, voted against it, spoke against it, but I didn't filibuster it, and I regretted afterwards that I didn't, and that bill went through, and I'm not sure even I could have stopped it even with that, but I made a promise to myself, if something involving the Constitution and people's rights came up again, I wasn't going to just, use the traditional means of taking it on, whatever I had to do to try and stop it. This bill, the FISA bill, and by the way, the people organizing the FISA bill, for those who may not be aware of it, dates back about 30 years. Frank Church and Republicans and Democrats some 30 years ago put together a bill that would allow us to gather intelligence to protect our country while simultaneously guaranteeing that people's rights weren't going to be assaulted. And that bill went through with one negative vote on it some 30 years ago, and over the years has been amended 30 times to sort of keep up to date with technologies and the like. What happened here is that about early in the 2002 Bush administration, they decided they'd go directly to the telecommunications industry without any court orders and got them to go along with basically eavesdropping, listening in, spying on millions of Americans, all their faxes, phones, emails and the rest, and did so for five straight years.
Is it conceivable, by the way, that they were, we know that, for example, out of Orrin Hatch's office, one of his assistants had actually hacked into Teddy Kennedy's computer for over a year, and they knew, you know, and they were reading his personal emails about the Democratic strategy on federal judge appointments. Is it possible that they were also listening in on you and other Democrats' messages?
It's very possible. It's all there. There was no governor on this at all. It was a vacuum cleaner out here. You know, the law allows people to listen to foreigners here who may be doing things and without court orders. But this is what a vacuum cleaner that was an office opened up, a secret office. We only know this because of Mark Klein. It was a whistleblower who worked for 22 years at AT&T and discovered after the fact that this was all going on. In fact, he was participating in it. He helped set up the system, but didn't know that it wasn't being done without a court order or a warrant from the FISA courts, which is what you've got to have. And, of course, this went on for years, only found out about it, of course, because there was a whistleblower, Mark Klein, to let us know what went on.
Right.
So they wanted to give grant immunity to all the telephone companies having done this. First of all, the Bush administration wanted to grant itself immunity in addition to the telephone companies. The committee said, no, we're not going to grant you immunity, but we're going to grant immunity to all these telephone companies. Quest did not do this, by the way.
Right.
Quest refused to turn over and participate in this effort here without a court order. They said, give us a court order. We have to respond to that. But in the absence of the court order, we're not going to be turning over to allow you to spy on our customers here. So not every company, rolled over at the behest of the Bush administration.
Right. Well, as you said on the floor of the Senate yesterday, it's not like these guys are using interns or paralegals to be doing their legal work. They've got lawyers. They knew
what they were doing. In fact, AT&T helped write the original FISA legislation back in the 1970s. And believe me, their lawyers talked to each other. I mean, this is not, as I say, we're innocents in all of this. They clearly knew what was going on and decided it was in their self-interest to comply with the Bush administration's request rather than comply with the law here. And they made that choice. And here, and I just don't believe you grant, blanket immunity to companies here who did this.
Right.
Why not your medical records tomorrow? Why not your financial records? Where does it stop? When do we stand up and say, no, enough is enough, no more? And so I know the staff and Iowa and others were concerned that I was leaving the state with a few days to go before the caucuses, but I'm not in this stuff. I mean, candidly, Tom, I care about winning, obviously, but I care about things more deeply than winning or losing elections. And I care deeply about the Constitution, care about the Bill of Rights, care about liberties and freedoms we have in this country, and firmly believe that you don't become more secure by giving them up. Quite the opposite. I think you become a lot less secure when you do give them up.
Yeah.
And so that's the reason I went back. And yesterday we had a lot of good help on the floor and spent 11 hours there. And leadership and others decided we'd, take that bill down. They're going to come back to it again in January. And so it's not over with, but at least for the time being, there's no legislation that went sliding through in the Congress here that gives a blanket retroactive immunity to the phone companies. And I'm going to fight it tooth and nail. We're not done fighting. And as long as that provision's in the bill, I'll do everything I can to stop it.
A couple of procedural questions. We're talking with Senator Chris Dodd here. First of all, I understand you put a hold on this bill and that Senator Reid chose to ignore that hold, although he doesn't generally ignore the holds of Republicans. Do I have that right?
Well, again, I going back, I revisiting history, I'll tell you this much. Yesterday, Senator Reid, the majority leader on the floor, announced that he agreed with me on this provision and is going to support me in the striking that provision from the bill.
Okay.
And
great.
So Harry Reid was certainly could have done a lot of things yesterday that made my life more difficult. As the majority leader, their powers the leader has, and he did not in any way try to use those powers in an adverse way here against me. And at the end of the day, agreed that we were on the right thing and the right position of this issue, and I welcome that support. It means a lot.
So although we had one piece of legislation out of the Intelligence Committee that granted the immunity, another out of the Judiciary Committee that didn't.
Correct.
I would argue that, Harry Reid had the power to simply bring the Judiciary Committee forward. But, he did whatever he did for whatever reasons he did. I realize you don't want to characterize him negatively. And in fact, it sounds like in some ways he was, to some extent, a hero of the day, at least mid and after the fact.
Well, he was. He was helpful. And, right. And look, what he was doing is, and this gets into the weeds on all of this, but this is what they call the regular order. And a regular order, you could make a case and the Intelligence Committee bill would be the regular order. And going to Judiciary first would have disrupted the regular order. But you're absolutely correct. The Judiciary Committee bill did not have that provision in the bill.
Right.
And Pat Leahy, who's been a star on constitutional issues and an ally of mine on these issues over many, many months, here was prepared, once if my amendment did not make it, if I had offered that, here, then he was prepared to offer the Judiciary Committee substitute, and I would strongly support that as well.
Yeah.
If those had failed, then, of course, we would have continued to filibuster against the bill here rather than let it go forward.
Okay. And I know you have to get going. Just
no, but listen, I'm going to tell you something. Let me thank your listeners. I mean, this would not have happened. I mean, I'm, you know, pleased it worked out well. Pleased this bill is gone, at least for the time being. We'll be back at it again. But also, I want to tell you something. 11,000 people, listeners to Air America, people who follow these issues, sent 600,000 emails to opinion centers around the country over a period of a handful of days here on this issue. Right. And so I want to thank your listeners out there for caring about this, for weighing in and making a difference. They do make a difference. And I want you to know, when you communicate and talk with people about what you care about, passionately care about, it does make a difference. So
Senator
thank you, America, and thank you, your listening audience.
Well, thank you. And Senator Dodd, finally, between now and January, what should we be doing to make sure that you prevail again in January?
Well, just keep an eye on this thing here. We're going to see what happens over the next few weeks on this thing here, but keep on letting people know, members know, staffs know, and so forth, how much you care about this here, and that you're watching carefully how people vote. You want those provisions struck from the bill.
Right.
That giving retroactive immunity is a dreadful precedent. It undermines our rights. You need to send a message. This is not the good law in the books that allows for surveillance, but it allows so only when you protect individual rights.
Senator Chris Dodd, and the website for your campaign is?
Is chrisdodd.com.
As one might expect. Senator Chris Dodd.
Not a complicated one, Tom.
Very best of luck on your campaign, and thanks so much for all the years that you've so ably represented not just your state, but the entire United States and the United States Senate. You've done a marvelous job.
And happy holidays to everybody.
Thank you, and very much to you, too.
Thanks,
Senator Chris Dodd. It's 43 minutes past the hour. Chris Dodd, the hero of the day yesterday. I just have nothing other to say than congratulations to Chris Dodd. Probably should have played the applause for him while he was on the air. I want to finish this Don Siegelman audio, just a little bit of this Don Siegelman audio. Again, this is, you know, as Senator Dodd pointed out, the Bush administration illegally may well have been listening. I mean, the main goal of this wiretapping might not have been Al-Qaeda. This isn't how Chris Dodd put it. This is how I'm putting it. Might not have been Al-Qaeda. It might have been the Democratic leadership. Consider what Don Siegelman was talking about.
The chronology really is this. On Tuesday night, the election officials throughout the state had made their tabulations and had announced their results publicly. Don Siegelman had won the election.
This is Don Siegelman, the Democratic governor of Alabama, who ran for re-election, and he thought he won.
After midnight, in one county, 6,700 votes were switched. By the way, when they changed the vote, when they recounted the votes in Baldwin County, it was odd that the only person who lost votes was me. It didn't affect a single other race. Not one vote changed that night from the original count to the final count based on the recount that was done after midnight, after the polling officials had gone. Now, one would expect that if there was some kind of computer glitch or some kind of computer programming error, that it might have affected more than one race. But it further raised suspicions about vote stealing when the votes came back and were certified, and the only person who lost votes was Don Siegelman, the Democrat, and the only person who gained votes was Bob Rowley, the Republican.
And now Don Siegelman in federal jail for giving a campaign contributor a unpaid advisory position. I mean, this is after all the other charges against him were thrown out. He dared to say the election was stolen.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Chipmunks roasting on an open fire. Hot sauce dripping from their toes. Yuletide squirrels, fresh filleted by the choir. They poked hot skewers through their nose. Everybody knows some pepper and a garlic clove help to make them seasoned right. Tiny rats with a crisp golden coat will really hit the spot tonight. And now when Santa sees his train,
seems a little weird to me.
Some homemade chipmunk jerky.
Homemade chipmunk jerky. Oh, man. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. You know, actually, before I wrap this hour up, rather than picking up your calls on this, this is so important. Don Siegelman, the most famous political prisoner in the United States. I just want to share it. And now the audio is surfacing of the interview that he did some 3.5 years ago because he's been under lockdown. Keep in mind, the woman who prosecuted him is one of the federal attorneys who kept her job. I've been saying all along they're the ones you have to keep your eye on. Her husband was Bob Riley's campaign manager, the guy who, according to Don Siegelman, stole the election from him in the middle of the night. The advisor to the prosecutor's husband who was running the campaign of the Republican was Karl Rove. And this is Don Siegelman, not quite speaking from the grave, but it's a few years old, but this has just come up speaking, because he can't speak right now, because the federal government will not allow him to speak from federal prison, but telling the story of what happened.
The next day we woke up, let me say this, I went to sleep thinking I'd won. I was awoken by my staff about 4:30 in the morning and saying that there's been a second count of the votes. Since we went to bed, the second count shows you losing the election by 1,500 votes. The next morning, we scrambled, demanded a hand recount. Later that day, on Wednesday, the Republicans, contrary to state law, certified the results. Bob Riley, oddly enough, the Republican candidate, was the one who made the official announcement of the certification of the results from Baldwin County at a press conference on Wednesday morning about 11 o'clock.
Valley Strange, and Don Siegelman continues.
Bob Riley, my Republican opponent, the evening of the election, after the official results were announced that showed that I was the winner in Baldwin County, and before anybody knew that there was anything wrong with the votes in Baldwin County, made the statement publicly over state television that something was wrong with the votes in Baldwin County and they were going to get to the bottom of it. That alerted our campaign team, you know, that we should be watching Baldwin County because we knew that the Republicans were doing something there. But we didn't have access to the courthouse. They had locked the doors, they had thrown, you know, everybody out. Everybody had gone home. So who actually from Bob Riley's camp directed people to get in there and to do another recount, whether, you know, he made the phone call, one of his staffers made the phone call. But what we do know is that someone in the sheriff's office ran the ballots, ran the new tabulation.
And he's not sure exactly who it was who stole the election. Glenn Wilson, a former Christian Science Monitor correspondent. And this is Don Siegelman's daughter telling us this. Larissa Alexandrovna in Raw Story interviewing his daughter says, Glenn Wilson, a former Christian Science Monitor correspondent who now publishes and writes for his news site, locustfort.net, posted a piece in June stating that Dan Gans, Riley's chief of staff, the Republican guy running for governor, his chief of staff during the would-be governor's time as U.S. representative for Alabama's 3rd District, electronically changed the results, giving a razor-thin edge to Riley, the Republican, who went on to win the state by 3,120 votes. And Don Siegelman again.
From our understanding of how electronic voting machines work and how computers work, that it would be virtually impossible to produce two different results using the same data, that some human being had to come in and do something to manipulate those returns.
See, he's documenting the theft of an election here.
There should not have been a recount. That was an unofficial recount. The official results, the way Alabama law works is that the precincts report to the county. There are poll watchers there representing each party and the news media. The election officials of the county, the sheriff, the probate judge, and the circuit clerk, who in this case were all Republicans, that night they announced the official results for Baldwin County. Those results should have been the results that were certified sometime after noon on Friday following the election.
But they weren't, because Karl Rove and the husband of the federal prosecutor who is running Bob Riley, the Republicans' campaign, made sure that they won't. I mean, this is absolutely mind-boggling. Mark in San Francisco, California. Hey, Mark, just a few seconds here before we've got to wrap up this hour.
All right. Well, it obviously begs the question, how do we use peaceable means to change and redress our grievances if they've corrupted the voting system?
We need to be in touch with, just like with what Chris Dodd was talking about earlier, if we raise enough hell, then politicians do pay attention, and we need to be raising absolute hell about this. The theft of the election system, Bob Riley, first of all, or excuse me, Don Siegelman, Bob Riley's the Republican, who stole the election with the aid of Karl Rove, in the opinion of at least this person. We need to be calling our elected representatives and saying, number one, we want a congressional investigation of Karl Rove's role in the theft of the Alabama election by Bob Riley and the imprisonment by the federal prosecutor, the U.S. attorney, one of the ones who kept their jobs because they were loyal Bushies, and her husband, who was running the campaign for the Republican against Don Siegelman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Does Iraq have nukes? This is an interesting one. Yeah, MSNBC sharing this with us.
The president was asked about Iran, but watch the president's reaction when the speaker made a faux pas.
I'm concerned about the nations like Iraq, who now have nuclear weapons.
Iran
and Iraq both.
Not Iraq.
But my question would be, yeah.
What was that, Jeff Gannon asking the question?
This genome.
Yeah,
is like,
this is just, totally bizarre. It's totally bizarre. Anyhow, strange stuff going on. The Don Siegelman situation, which I was ranting about in the last hour, I just want to wrap this up. Then we'll pick up your phone calls here, right straight off. It seems, frankly to me, that everything ultimately is secondary to this. I mean, here you've got one of the guys who was prosecuting this case who was made a federal judge. Here you've got another prosecutor whose husband was in charge of the Republicans' campaign. The Republicans in the middle of the night in a Republican district with Republicans looking over their shoulders. No Democrats present. No transparency. Say, oh, yeah, Don Siegelman lost and Bob Riley, the Republican, won. We just found some votes in the middle of the night. Didn't affect any of the other races, only the gubernatorial race. All these people who voted Republican, they decided not to. They voted Democratic and everything else, but they changed. It's incredible. It's incredible. And even when MSNBC, Don Abrams, and good on him for at least putting his toe into the water on this thing, even when they talked about that, they never talked about the issue of election fraud. The issue of election fraud, this, in my opinion, is a huge issue. If we don't have a vote, what do we have in the United States? We got nothing. If we don't have our votes, we've got nothing. And the Republicans getting ready to steal another election. I mean, we'll see how it comes out. Remember Paul Weyrich talking about how, no, we don't want people to vote. And they're working really hard to make sure that people are not voting. This is Paul Weyrich, the Republican strategist who claimed credit for getting Reagan into office, who worked on Bush Sr.'s first campaign, who worked on Bush Jr.'s campaign.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Indeed. In the meantime, just a little quick news here. Some of the FBI agents involved are challenging the CIA's description of Abu Zubaydah, this guy who was waterboarded. They're saying his credibility dropped as a consequence of this. The CIA is saying, oh, he's an important insider whose disclosures under intense pressure saved lives. All of a sudden, remember the CIA guy comes out and he's very nice and very personable and even a little kind of metrosexual and very friendly. Well, yeah, I don't, you know, looking back on it, I don't think I liked waterboarding, but, you know, it did produce some good information. And no, FBI agents are now saying, no, it didn't. In fact, it hurt. It hurt our investigations. By the way, last night the House passed a massive year-end omnibus spending bill. You know, stuff is happening. Things are getting done. The White House reports that the omnibus bill, quote, has cut all funding for continuing development next year of a new nuclear warhead. So, some good news. The Democrats are doing some things right. I mean, it is so much better than when the Republicans were in charge of the House and the Senate, and there were no vetoes, there was no challenge, there were no investigations, everything was being covered up. If only the Democrats had gotten control 2 years earlier. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number, Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hey, let me see if I can tie the 2 points of your first hour together with Siegelman and the work that Chris Dodd's doing against this FISA bill.
Yes, sir.
We, in just a few short hours in Denver, Joseph Nacio from Quest Communications is going up on his appeal, the 6-year sentence that he got for supposed insider trading.
Well, it may well have been insider trading, but again, when you look at the federal prosecutors who Bush appointed, they prosecuted over 600 Democrats and roughly 100 Republicans. And we don't have the statistics yet, but we don't know how many of those 100 Republicans that they prosecuted were actually up on charges before the Republicans came into office.
Damn.
Go ahead. Dave? Dave? Dave, you still there?
I'm still here, sir.
Okay, what were you saying?
Okay, I'm sorry. What I was going to say is that Joseph Nacio is clearly being punished. I mean, as you look at this case, and I followed this thing, they're being punished because they did not play ball with the federal government on the FISA spying. And this whole case, they're denying the evidence to come forward, saying it's state secrets. The whole case with Quest, and I think it's time that maybe we ought to look at common ground with the Republicans. One thing that surpasses ideology is losing money. And they beat this stock up. This stock was at 42. In that February before Joseph Nacio said no. His lawyer said no, and he followed the law. That company's being punished because they played by the rules. They followed the law. Now, AT&T, Verizon, and all the others who want immunity, they still want to keep their contracts, which were pulled from Quest, the DOD contracts, were pulled from Quest when they didn't comply with the FISA request.
Right, and suddenly
contracts should probably go to Quest, the company that followed the law, and the AT&T and Verizon should not be rewarded by keeping the contracts and the immunity. I'm against the immunity entirely. But here's Joseph Nacio, just like Siegelman, and he is being prosecuted on this.
Yeah, I mentioned that on the air yesterday, and somebody called in and said, oh, but he was actually guilty of crimes. And, you know, perhaps he was. How many of these CEOs of these companies, if you really start looking carefully, might you be able to find something? I don't know. And I don't want to be in a position, and I doubt you do either, Dave, where we're defending Joseph Nacio for what may or may not be criminal activity, presumably.
I will. And because I've looked at this, and I'm a trader. I follow the stocks. I looked at this. What happened to Joseph Nacio is that he was going to report earnings from those DOD contracts, which he could not even tell his own staff about because they were so secret. when they pulled those, he was counting on those earnings.
Oh, that's right. And he was selling stock or buying stock, one or the other, based on the assumption of those earnings and making projections based on the assumption of those earnings. When those earnings didn't come through, the stock price crashed. And that's what they busted him for, was trading against us, you know, like having insider information as if he knew that the price was going to crash when he didn't. Or do I have it the other
Correct.
Way around? Yeah.
Correct. In fact, had those contracts come through, he would have been selling his stocks at a discount.
Right.
Because the stock would have risen on those contract awards from the government.
Right.
But he couldn't even tell the details to his own CFO on this. Now, this is ridiculous. I mean, they forced the stock to come down. I think it's almost time for a class action lawsuit of Quest shareholders against the government.
Well, I think it's time for a major, you know, independent prosecutor investigation here. I mean, the level of criminality on the part of the Bush White House and the Republican handmaidens in the House and Senate, and particularly in the RNC, consultants like Karl Rove.
Bingo, RICO Act against the GOP.
That's right. Possible. Unfortunately, the RICO Act, the way it's written, it can't be used against political parties or people participating in them. But there are conspiracy laws, there are felony conspiracy laws and things like that, and frankly, I think we need to bring them out. We need to go after these guys. Dave, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. Diane in Middletown, New Jersey. Hey, Diane, got about a minute before a break. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I'll make it quick. To use your phrase, good on you for bringing this Don Siegelman issue to light. I am outraged. Quick question that I'm not clear on. Why is Don Siegelman and his wife and family not allowed to speak to the press?
His daughter actually did an interview with Larissa Alexandrovna over at Raw Story.
Mm-hmm.
I think typically the press, particularly the corporate media, but professional journalists, as it were, you know, they'd rather get it from the horse's mouth. And he's not allowed to speak because he's in federal prison. And apparently the rules of federal prison are that once you're in federal prison, except with specific permission of a judge or something, you can't talk. And they're not allowing him to appeal. But in my opinion, and the opinion of many people who have looked at this thing, we're talking major trumped up charges, you know, just an absolute miscarriage of justice here. And as to how can we help him, what can we do about him? Let's get a federal investigation going of what went on in Alabama, what went on with Bob Riley and Mr. Canary, the husband of the woman who prosecuted Don Siegelman, who was running Bob Riley's campaign. And Karl Rove, the guy who was apparently running the whole thing, 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
I think we need a gunslinger. Somebody talk to tame this town. I think we need a gunslinger. There'll be justice all around.
Yeah, we need Henry Waxman, the mustache of justice. We need Pat Leahy. We need John Conyers. We need these guys to be continuing the great investigative work they have begun in the few short months that they've had power in the United States House and Senate. Welcome back. The Tom Hartman Program, by the way, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. And I would assert it is a right, and it is stated in the Declaration of Independence and clearly, strongly implied in the Constitution of the United States. So, anyhow, the omnibus, I mentioned just very briefly that the omnibus appropriations bill, they basically pulled together a whole bunch of different federal funding bills and passed them last night. It was not the president's budget. It was not the president's budget. The chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, David Obey, says the omnibus bill is totally inadequate to meet the long-term needs of the country, but it is a whole lot better than we would have had without a Democratic Congress, and points out that if the president's budget had been passed, it would have cut 800 grants for medical research at the National Institutes of Health. If the president's budget instead last night had been passed, it would have cut programs that provide access to health care by $595 million. It would have cut rural health initiatives by 50%. It would have cut critical funds in education by $1.2 billion. It would have eliminated all the student aid programs except for Pell Grants and Work Study. It would have cut vocational education by 50%. I thought we were supposed to be investing in our people. No, not according to the Bushies. It would have cut support for state and local law enforcement by $1.4 billion. It would have cut Homeland Security grants for police, firefighters, and medical personnel by $1.1 billion. It would have shortchanged highway infrastructure. It would have cut renewable energy programs by $195 million. It would have frozen scientific research in renewable energy programs. I mean, that's what the Republicans wanted. That was the Republican agenda. And the Democrats said, no thanks. And, you know, good on them. They got this thing through. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. I'm going to drop into our live chat room. Drop by TomHartmann.com. You can also participate in the blog. You can comment on your thoughts on the show and whatnot on the homepage at TomHartmann.com. There's also a blog over at AirAmerica.com. Simon in San Francisco, California, listening on K-Green. Hey, Simon, what's up?
Yeah, this is Simon from San Francisco, off-duty AT&T employee.
Oh-ho!
And so, I wanted to mention the fact that every year they have us do mandatory coverage on the Privacy of Communications Act.
In other words, you have to go through a training program where you are taught about the legalities of these issues.
Right, and we have to sign or decline to sign, depending, this document. And it's basically, if I'm on somebody's phone line shooting trouble, trying to hear noise and static and monitoring their phone line, and they come off the hook and discuss anything, illegal, illegal, or otherwise, I can't repeat it.
Right.
So we have a cognitive dissonance at the phone company.
Yeah. So this very company that's telling you, you can't listen in on people, this company has been listening in on people and feeding that information to the Bush administration, and it may well even be partisan stuff. It may well be that what Richard Nixon did, wiretapping his Democratic enemies, is the exact same thing that the Bush administration is doing, wiretapping Democrats, and the company that you work for, AT&T, went along with it, you know, just fine, thank you very much. And yet they're teaching you, you're the employees of AT&T, oh, you can't do this. We, you know, so obviously their lawyers know what this is and what's right and what's wrong here.
Besides that, we also have another issue of the customer's calling records and the phone number they call and the call details.
Right.
That the people see in the business office.
Right.
We're not allowed to discuss those either.
There you go. There you go.
It depends on the job you have, but there seems to be no resemblance to reality.
Yeah, and this isn't just company policy. This is the company informing you what the law is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Simon, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. I appreciate it.
Good.
I'm sorry. My apologies, Simon. Already gone. Mark in Hansville, Washington. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Just great. What's up?
So I just heard about the whole Siegelman issue. I hadn't heard about this at all. I'm totally outraged. This is crazy.
This is the election of 2002. This guy's been in prison basically since then for daring to say that the election was stolen from him.
Well, I've already called my representative, Jay Inslee, to this morning as soon as I heard this. But what I didn't hear on the call, and maybe it's because I was in the car listening on the radio, was that Siegelman had brought fraud charges up against ExxonMobil. Did you guys mention that?
No, I didn't. I didn't frankly know about that.
The state of Alabama, and I'm reading from Harper's November 4th, 2007, Scott Horton.
Oh, yeah, we had Scott on last week. I confess I have not yet read the entire article.
Well, but can I read this paragraph? It's short.
Yeah, we got 20 seconds.
All right, the state of Alabama believes that it was victimized by ExxonMobil. It committed fraud and underpaid by the state in a contract dispute over natural gas pump from Mobile Bay. They were awarded a $3.6 billion judgment, and then it was appealed, and the state high court turned it over.
Interesting. And had Don Siegelman continued as governor, then this probably would have hastened Karl Rove and George Bush's buddy, Ken Lay's demise, or, you know, off to prison with him or something like that. Mark, thanks.
This guy's now in jail, for God's sake.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know. It's terrible. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program. Call Tom at
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartmann here with you. TomHartmann.com for our live chat room and our blog and our message boards and all kinds of cool stuff. AirAmerica.com, the blog over there at the Tom Hartman page, and on the homepage. And our telephone number, toll-free, all across the United States and around the world, 866-303-2270. Henry in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Henry, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, Tom. It's my understanding that there were two bills that were brought up for vote yesterday. One that included amnesty for the telecommunications company, and the other one that did not include amnesty. And the one that Harry Reid allowed to come to the floor was the one that allowed the amnesty.
Yeah, and I asked Chris Dodd about that, and he said that that was in fact the case, that the one, and as I had reported yesterday, that the one with amnesty came out of the Intelligence Committee, the one without amnesty came out of the Judiciary Committee, Pat Leahy's committee, and what Chris Dodd said was that Harry Reid was not showing a preference for one bill over the other, that the order that they came out or something. You know, he said it's a matter of the rules of order, some technical thing that has to do with how the Senate works, and that should have been that the one with the amnesty was the one that, according to the appropriate rules of the Senate, needed to be brought up first. And so he stood up and filibustered it. And so this isn't a Harry Reid's a bad guy story, apparently, so much as just, you know, hey, that's how the Senate works. It's really more a Chris Dodd is a hero story, in my opinion.
Okay. So does that mean that this has to come for a vote again in January when they come back out from vacation?
Yes, sir. And that's why we need to be calling. Go to callcongress.org. It's a page on our website that has all the toll-free phone numbers for the House of Representatives and the Senate. That gets you the Capitol Hill operator. And if you're not sure who your two senators are, just tell them what state you're from, and they will connect you to either one. They'll tell you who they are. And call both of your senators, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, and say, we do not want to give the phone companies immunity from breaking the law in this FISA bill.
Well, we seem to have the good and the bad, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein here in California. So.
Yeah, well, you know, Dianne Feinstein isn't terrible, but Barbara Boxer is a real star. She is
exactly.
An absolute rock star, and you know, God bless her and good on her in every way imaginable. Henry, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Let's see here. Barry in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Barry, you want to disagree with me? You go right to the front of the line. What's up?
Well, I listen to you, and I listen to Rush, and I listen to these talk shows when I'm driving, and the thing that bothers me is, you guys talk to your base. I'm a Republican. I have a lot of Democratic friends. We debate the issues. We don't call each other names. Liberal's not a bad word. Conservative's not a bad word. But I understand your talk shows have to talk to your base and get them excited and discuss everything. You're talking about the budget going past. I was reading about it in the Wall Street Journal. It's not that they cut everything. It's they cut the rate of increase. But when we listen to the news, it sounds like, God, we're wiping out everything in the country, you know?
Okay, well, let's just go through these things then, Barry. For example, the president's budget. This isn't the one that got passed, but the one that the president proposed would have cut 800. Yeah, would have cut eight. Well, you know, it would have had Republican support. It would have cut 800 specific grants, individual grants for medical research at the National Institutes of Health. That's not reducing the rate of growth.
Well, wait a minute. How much were we spending last year, and how much are we spending this year? We're still spending more money.
Okay. You don't think that the value of the dollar is going down, or that maybe in the area of medicine we have increased needs?
Well, let me tell you something. When I pay my bills every month, I have to look at my income and I have to decide what to pay. I'm all for national health care. I mean, I'm a Republican, not a right-wing Republican. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Everything's got labels today. That's the trouble. We don't have any civil discussions. We insult each other. We call Bushies, like you say. I mean, the office of the president.
That's actually a phrase that Dana Perino, the Bush's press secretary, uses.
What is wrong in trying to make the government accountable? Look at the roads. You mentioned about bridges and roads. How much money do we pay in gasoline taxes that is supposed to take care of the bridges and roads?
Well, that's the big problem, Barry, is that the gasoline taxes are not. Let me just respond to that. You mentioned gasoline taxes, and I agree with you on that. The problem is that the gasoline taxes, when they were passed back 30 years ago, by and large, the last time that they were, you know, seriously reconfigured, is that they were passed as a fixed dollar amount rather than as a percentage of the cost of a gallon of gasoline. So over time, as gasoline has gone up in price, the percentage of it that is a gas tax has gone down. The gas tax has not gone up, but the cost of asphalt has gone through the roof because it's made out of petroleum. So the gas tax no longer is enough to maintain the highways. And everybody is terrified to raise the taxes on it because, oh, my God, Ronald Reagan's ghost will get us.
I don't care about that, but why don't you put out the exact billions of dollars collected? I know what you're saying. And then say how much of that billions has the government actually spent on roads and bridges and not bicycle paths, public transportation. That's the trouble. Money is earmarked, like Social Security, but it never gets spent where it's earmarked. It's like the lotteries in the state.
Actually, Social Security is a separate fund, and all the money that goes into Social Security comes in.
Why don't you guys put out the give the dollar amount that has been raised by all the tax, and then why don't you investigate, well, where was that money actually spent? You're going to find out a lot of it wasn't spent on the bridges and roads. It was spent in other areas because the governments and the states, you know, they fudged again. They're not required by law to actually spend it where they say they're going to spend it. And
so
the
bottom line, Harry, or Barry, excuse me, I'm sorry, I keep calling you Harry. The bottom line here, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that you're of the opinion that a lot of government spending is wasteful and unnecessary. And that
not a lot, but much of it. If we could just
okay, what for example?
If we could reduce waste by 1%, you know, we would be able to take care of Medicare.
No, I don't know that.
Well, if we could reduce the waste in government,
waste in the Pentagon. The Pentagon's missing $2 trillion. I'm with you on that.
That's part of the government, right? I'm not disagreeing with you. If we could just reduce waste, we could afford Medicare. We could have everybody insured in the country.
If we simply did away with the health insurance companies, we could afford Medicare.
Well, I don't, yeah, but where's the accountability in the government? I run a business. You know who I'm accountable to? I'm accountable to my employees. If I don't make a profit, I can't keep them employed. The government doesn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, I run a business, and I'm accountable to my employees and to myself, by the way.
Right.
And I would say that the government is accountable to you and me. And if you're not participating in the political process and you're not paying attention and you're not voting every 2 years...
What? The government's accountable to all of the interest groups. I'm just a peon, and I don't care whether they're conservative or Democrats or liberals or Republicans. All the interest groups are what really move our government.
Barry, that again goes back to this 1976 Supreme Court decision, Buckley versus Vallejo, where the Supreme Court ruled that whoever has the most money gets to have the loudest voice because money equals speech, and that's so wrong. And that's something that John Roberts built his career defending.
Don't you think it's insulting that Hillary Clinton, not only Hillary, but the Republican side, too, I'm not picking on Hillary, you have to raise $100 million to run for president of the United States?
Yes, I think it's a crime.
If you don't have the money, you never get into the system.
I agree. I think it's an absolute crime.
I mean, I grew up in Chicago, and I'm a Democratic machine, but we still talk to each other. What bothers me most today is we don't talk anymore. We use these insulting talk shows. In fact, the point is both parties have to run to their base, but in order to get elected, once you get the nomination, you have to come to the middle because your base can't elect you.
So, Barry, I'm hoping that you will join with me in calling for publicly funded elections. If every taxpayer in the United States, all 120 million of us more or less, if every taxpayer in the United States put in $6 a year, into a federal fund, it would be enough to pay for all the elections that are going on.
I think they should be federally funded, no private donations, everybody gets the same bucks, and then everybody's on a level.
Now, you realize that the Republicans have been fighting that for 45 years since FDR first proposed it.
You're right, and I agree with you. Like I say, I'm a Republican. Doesn't mean, and by the way, here's another thing. Just because I'm a Republican doesn't mean I automatically agree with everything my party does.
Well, I'm curious, why are you a Republican, Barry? You're in favor of a national health care program.
Well,
you're in favor of cutting the waste out of the Pentagon.
Well,
you're in favor of public funding of elections.
Because I'm a liberal Republican. In other words, I still believe in my party. Why would I desert it? It needs to be changed. There's nothing wrong with Republicans or Democrats. Both, would we want a one-party system in this country?
No, we wouldn't. And
I
congratulate you on that.
I'm a John McCain Republican, okay? And John McCain and I disagree with a lot what our party's doing. But I'm not going to jump from it. I'm going to try to change it and make it better.
Good on you,
Harry. More competitive.
Good on you. I wish you all the very best. Because I wrote an op-ed a while back that was titled "Republicans, Please Take Back Your Party."
I'm really upset that all these talks, they make liberalism sound bad and conservatives sound bad. They're not bad. It's when it's that Tony's phrase, right?
I understand, but aren't you a little concerned that, you know, and I realize you're going to say that this is a you know, name calling, but aren't you a little concerned that some crazies have taken over your party?
So, and didn't the crazies take over the Democrats at certain times?
There, you betcha. You betcha. There are some real crazies in the Democratic Party as well. I'll cop to that right off the top.
By the way, I am not anti-Hillary, but look what she has to say and do to appease her base when she knows to get elected, she's not going to do anything.
Hillary is not appeasing the base. John Edwards is talking to the base. Obama is sort of talking to the base. Chris Dodd is talking to the base. And Dennis Kucinich is talking to the base. Hillary, just sort of.
I got you. Well, anyway, yeah. It's great talking to you. I like listening to you. And I listen to Rush. I find these things entertaining more than informative at times.
Well, thank you, Barry. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. And good luck taking back the Republican Party. And I mean that sincerely. The Republican Party needs people of goodwill. It really desperately needs them. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week.
Then won't you tell me you're never more wrong? Christmas and New Year's, we'll find you at home. There'll be no more sorrow.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, on January 7th and 8th, we'll be doing our show live from New Hampshire. We'll be doing a radio row there on primary, the day before the primaries, and on primary day. Should be very entertaining. 866-303-2270, our phone number, Rebecca in Seattle. Hey, Rebecca.
Oh, hi, Tom. There are a couple things here that I really have been wanting to get out there, and I know you... you know, probably had this information, but just a slant on it, it sort of starts out with this idea about Nader not being responsible for what happened. And I know yesterday you gave all these other things, and those were all true, too, about people who were prevented from voting at all. But just the numbers. Bush officially won, and this ties in with black box voting and what you were talking about earlier with the situation in Alabama. Are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, great. Okay, so anyway, Bush officially won by 537, 543, whatever. Right. Now, the numbers are out there. Nader got 97,000 votes in Florida. And what continues to bother some of us, I had friends who voted for Nader, you know, and it breaks my heart what happened.
Yeah, you're talking to one of them, by the way.
I know what you said about how you and your wife, you know, split your vote and you voted in.
And we lived in Vermont where there was no chance that it was going to be close.
Right, right. And I understand that. But what happened up to the last minute, you know, Nader was on this, oh, they're Tweedledum, Tweedledee, they're all the same, it doesn't make a difference, you know.
I know.
And it just wasn't true. And he told friends that he would not do that. He would not be a spoiler. And then what happened, this is from a letter I just got from Black Box Voting, 2000, you know, just on election night, minus 16,000 votes, Volusia County, votes were inserted into the news totals from a paper ballot vote counting system. 7 minutes later, the networks called it for Bush. Right. And these 16,000, that would have been overridden if even half the people or a third of the people that voted for Nader in Florida had not done that. You know,
you're absolutely right. It would have been a lot harder for them to steal the election in Florida had Nader not been on the ballot. And that's why I so saluted David Cobb when he ran in 2004. Even though I didn't vote for him, I voted for John Kerry. But when he ran on the Green Party ticket, he said, if you're in a purple state, if you're in a state that could go either way, don't vote for me. Vote for John Kerry.
Right.
And he did not even run a campaign in states like Florida. Whereas he only ran in those clearly blue states, and the goal, again, was to get enough votes to get federal matching funds to strengthen the Green Party. And I think that was a very, very wise thing.
I understand that, and I agree with that.
David Cobb is one of my heroes for that reason.
Yeah. So what I see happening now, and this is what is causing me lots of distress now, is how the Democrats and progressives are attacking each other and exaggerating the stance of the other people. And I just feel like the Democrats and the progressives don't work together, you know, because I just...
They never have, Rebecca, and they never will, because the Democratic Party is a coalition of coalitions. Uh-huh. And the Republican Party, although it's had, you know, days where it was that, basically the Republican Party is the party of the rich and powerful in the United States. And they reach out to the average person by throwing them red meat, like, hey, the gays are going to get you.
And they're going to
take away your guns.
Or saying you might get rich someday, too, like us, you know.
That's right. But the bottom line is that the Republican Party is all about, it. You know, it's the party of the rich and powerful. And they, you know, typically, until Reagan came along, they were quite upfront about it. And even Reagan, you know, with his inaugural ball after Jimmy Carter had walked to his inaugural ball and Reagan had the whole limousine and everything, you know, and the, you know, charging for it. And I mean, it was a whole sea change. You know, the greed is good thing. It changed. And America adopted a different idea of what the American dream was, even, and of what America was. And I think it's a real tragedy. But I do agree with you that if Nader had not been on the ballot in Florida, that it would have been a lot harder for them to steal. But that doesn't mean that they wouldn't have stolen it, but it would have been a lot harder for them to steal. But the point that we have to, I think all as Americans have to point out, is that the election in Florida was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court stopped the count of that.
But you know, we wouldn't have even had to go there if this 16,000 vote fraud thing had been overridden by the numbers, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, and also, look at all the people who you know, in heavily Jewish areas who voted for Pat Buchanan.
Oh,
I know.
There was no
shortage of them at all. Yeah, Rebecca, well said, and thank you very much for bringing it up. Art in Seattle. Hey, Art.
Tom, I'm going to draw a historical parallel to the Dreyfus case, which you know about.
With Don Siegelman, you mean?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact, to my mind anyway, that this French officer, who was exiled and convicted and sent to Devil's Island, Governor Siegelman apparently was sent to a Devil's Island situation because he was unable to speak to the media or anybody else.
Yeah, give us a 20-second snapshot of the Dreyfus affair.
The Dreyfus case,
yeah.
A French officer by the name of Leon Dreyfus was convicted by an anti-Semitic French court of supplying information to the Germans just prior to the beginning of the 20th century, and he was unjustly convicted. And everybody threw him under the bus until Émile Zola, who I compare you to, wrote an article called J'accuse, and he said that this man was innocent, and it wasn't until a dozen years later that the man was restored to his commission in the French army just in time for World War I.
Yeah.
And what frightens me is that there are people who in the United States Senate and the Attorney General, Mukasey, and senators like Lieberman and Feinstein, who are willing to throw another Jewish person, Siegelman, under the bus rather than standing up for him. And
you think,
you think that
there's an element of anti-Semitism here as well?
Yes, of course there is. Siegelman started off as a Catholic, and he became Jewish because of his wife, who is Jewish. They have Jewish children. And I say this because I'm an atheist, so I don't have any dog in this fight.
Mm.
What I'm saying is that this is a disgrace, and I'm shocked that the Jewish senators and the Jewish Attorney General don't do a damn thing about this man Siegelman.
Yeah, well, Jewish or not, I'm shocked that they don't do something about the theft of an election and the imprisonment of an innocent guy, or the trumped-up charges, let's say, against a guy who might have done something that was questionable. Art, I appreciate the call, and thanks for the history lesson. Always appreciate it. 57 minutes past the hour.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program. The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the vast radical middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Lawrence Mitchell on the line. Yesterday, you'll recall, virtually the entire first hour of the program yesterday was how does an economy work? How is wealth created? And how, if you don't have core engines of the creation of wealth in the early years of this country, it was agriculture. In other words, converting labor into food. And then later on, as the Industrial Revolution came along, it was the manufacture of goods. If you don't have some creation of wealth at the bottom, at the base of the whole thing, and then that wealth spins off jobs, and then those jobs provide for other jobs like service jobs, if you don't have that, you've got nothing. And over the last 27 years, 26 years, we've seen the steady erosion of the true generation of wealth in the United States, and it's been replaced, frankly, by people moving money around. Lawrence Mitchell has written a book that is a great history, starting arguably back in the late 19th century, the speculation economy, how finance triumphed over industry. Lawrence Mitchell on the line with us. BK Pub, it's published by Barrett Kohler. BKPub.com is the website. Hey, Lawrence.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. You start out by talking about how in Delaware, as you drive into the state, it says, hey, no sales tax here. How does this little tiny state have no sales tax? This goes back to the chartermongering era.
Well, sure it does. And as I explain in the book, it actually all started in New Jersey before New Jersey was known for the turnpike. The idea of chartermongering was perfected by New Jersey as a way of raising revenue to pay off Civil War debt. It so happened that at the time that businesses had a business need to combine in part to keep ruinous competition down. And there were a couple of changes in New Jersey law that a real clever lawyer came up with that made that very easy at a time when it was illegal and difficult and expensive. They went and marketed these charters. They paid off their Civil War debt in 10 years. And the reason it's Delaware is that Woodrow Wilson, after he'd been elected president, but before he was inaugurated, convinced the New Jersey legislature to tighten up the law, repeal all this stuff that had allowed New Jersey to flourish. The legislature did. Everybody reincorporated in Delaware. And then when New Jersey changed its law back a few years later, it was too late. Delaware right. now gets 25% of its annual revenue from corporate charters.
Hey, I own a Delaware corporation. I mean, you know, half of the stock market, half of the, my understanding is that half of all the companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange are Delaware corporations.
That's pretty much right.
Yeah. And that in large part, this was the result of the state of Ohio in the 1880s, saying to John Rockefeller, what you're doing with your Standard Oil Trust of Ohio is a crime, and you're going to have to stop. And he basically said to the other states, okay, who's going to change their charter laws and let me come?